Does the rabbi's brain still work in Rosh Hashanah? We're going to see. So let's take a look at some of your questions. If I sit down, can you see me? It's the same as if I stand up. Why is there a reader's Kaddish during the service? How is that different from the Kaddish we all say? Superb question. There are four Kaddishes in Judaism. The reader's Kaddish, which is called the Chatzi Kaddish, the half Kaddish, the mourner's Kaddish, Kaddish de Rabbanan, the Kaddish that you say for the rabbis, and the Kaddish that is said especially at the cemetery by traditional Jews, which is a different kind of Kaddish, which we say only once during the year, and that's going to be at Yom Kippur at the end of the service. You know, all those telotones, and I'm reading by myself, and you're all going, what is she reading? That's the fourth Kaddish, which doesn't get used very often. It's the only place it appears in the Reform movement is in the Yom Kippur service. So the origin of the Kaddish. When the prayer book, before the prayer book was really being established, there were communities, and communities were trying to figure out how to use prayers and how to acknowledge life cycle events. And what I love about the Reader's Kaddish is the Reader's Kaddish, which we rabbis affectionately call the comma of the traditional service, because the purpose of the Reader's Kaddish is to tell you, we are moving from one part of the service to another. In the days when rabbis didn't talk to the congregation, or there might not have been a rabbi leading worship, a Reader's Kaddish says, section A is ending, section B is beginning. When I was a little girl in a traditional congregation, all I knew is that they said the Reader's Kaddish a million times. You know, oh, early prayers are done, Reader's Kaddish, Baruch Hu is coming. Reader's Kaddish, Torah service is coming. Reader's Kaddish, oh, we're almost done. I'm not telling you the fact that my finger used to go numb because I kept it at Aleinu because all I wanted was Oneg. Services to me were all about yellow cake with chocolate icing. So Oneg can actually turn people into rabbis, but that's another answer. So the Reader's Kaddish actually was the comma of the service. It was the way people actually got to know how the service was moving. And it is an affirmation of the kingdom of God. It has absolutely nothing to do with death. But the little-known fact about the Reader's Kaddish is how it became associated, the main Kaddish, became associated with death. People who came, who were in mourning, needed to be acknowledged by the community. I look around. Some of you are here because you're in mourning or you're ending your year of mourning. These are important moments. And so with all the different readers' kaddishes in the service, different people were asked to stand up in their time of grieving to lead the readers' kaddish. And it was the way for the community to say, pumpernickel is hurting. Rye bread needs a little extra help. You know, Jochen Flatz needs our support because he lost his child. And so the Reader's Kaddish became a wonderful way to acknowledge people in their grief. And so even though it doesn't really refer to grief, that's how the two became associated in the earliest times of the establishment of the prayer book. Oh, I love this question. Where is Oneg tonight? Well, we never... We did not think about Oneg tonight. I just want you to know. I was here all day. We did not think about Oneg tonight. We were dealing with, oh, Andrew's going to come in and set up for Yom Kippur. Let's make sure we have the right seats, all of that. No, Oneg arrived. You know, we didn't really think about it. So Oneg is in the lobby, and there's a lot of it, because when I looked in the kitchen, I said, wow, we're having 10 people and 10 platters. So I'm really glad there's a lot of it, because clearly the people who ordered knew you would come. Why do we have Oneg? Oh, I love this question. So the history of Oneg, the longer term Oneg Shabbat. Where is the first appearance of the word Oneg Shabbat? In the Mishneh Torah written by Maimonides, probably written between 1170 and 1180, is the first mention of the term Oneg Shabbat. It has nothing to do with dessert. Maimonides is teaching in that passage that even if you are dirt poor, even if you don't have two coins to rub together, on Shabbat you are obligated to ta'anuk, to just what it says, hitgangu. You have to enjoy the Sabbath. So Onuk Shabbat became a phrase that Maimonides coins for really owning the Sabbath as your own. You're not supposed to wallow in your poverty. You're supposed to make Shabbat special. Now, we know that in Exodus 31, in Bishamru, there's the word hitangu, but it's really Maimonides who commands people that they really need to have Onuk Shabbat. When did the food come in? The food comes in when Chaim Nachman Bialik, that great European poet who wrote in Hebrew, who tried to revitalize the Hebrew language, left Europe because he had this, you know, he went from Eastern Europe, then he went to Germany, and then in 1924, he goes to Tel Aviv. And in Tel Aviv, he is bringing his poetry and he's bringing his publishing and all of those things, and he invents Onuk Shabbat. And for Israelis, this was a cultural shift. It was a paradigm shift. Saturday afternoon, you could walk into any Israeli's house and there would be coffee and cake. And when I was growing up as a teenager in Israel, that's what I loved most. Is we used to go, when I would visit a family from school, you would go from neighbor to neighbor, the coffee, the cake, the tea, it was all on the table, and you just went from one house to the next. So I could come to Deb's house and she would have cake ready. Now, there was some competition on the cake, but that's a whole other story. Some of it was dry. Never at the Glicklands. So Bialik says, we're going to create a community. And we're going to create a community where Shabbat exists, and Shabbat is going to be what Maimonides wanted it to be. And so Bialik is credited with creating Onuk Shabbat on Saturdays. And now the rest of the story, which you will probably not find in most books at all. And that is how did Onuk Shabbat come to be Friday night in synagogues? And the answer is architecture. Early synagogues had no social space. Early synagogues, you've traveled all over the world. There's a bima in the center. It's beautiful. David photographs it. And they go, isn't that lovely? David brings home the photograph. He shows it to me. Where is there a place? If you want to have a kiddush or cake or whatever, it's in the back of the sanctuary. And then we come to America. And in America, we start to build, based on the writings, really, of Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of the Reconstructionist movement, who wrote a book that was over 700 pages, Judaism as a Civilization. And in it, he suggests that we have the social hall. Why? Because Jews need a place to congregate. We weren't called congregations before America. America is a congregationalist country. We borrowed that from the Protestants. And so they built all over America synagogues with social halls. Now, if you go to places like Manhattan, you'll see that places like Central Synagogue and Temple Emmanuel weren't originally built with social halls. I remember going to Central Synagogue once and saying, oh, you have to go like across the street to have Onuk? But those older buildings were not designed with that in mind. The architecture of the suburban synagogue of the 1950s was sprawling. How many of you grew up in one of those synagogues with a social hall? It was great. It gave you a place to have Onuk, a place for the caterer to have bar and bat mitzvahs, and overflow seating for high holy days. How small can we make the sanctuary? How big can we make the social hall? Because after all, we're going to need bazaars and all of these other things that the social hall will do. But the social hall is really what happened to create Onuk Shabbat for Jews in America. A little bit of Jewish trivia. Can you explain the Jewish significance of the Vulcan greeting? Live long and prosper. We just read this in confirmation class. Leonard Nimoy was Jewish. Bless you, bless you. He was a member of Temple Israel of Hollywood. And when they needed a symbol, he thought back to the earliest Jewish symbol for God. Shaddai, the oldest name for God in the Torah, in the book of Genesis, Almighty. People think that the shin on your mezuzah stands for Shema, which is what's in the mezuzah. No, it stands for Shaddai. And some of you actually have the three letters Shaddai written on your mezuzot. Now, there is one mezuzah in this building that was hung upside down, and the shin is upside down. I've left it there. thinking, well, somebody will catch it, and when they do, I'll turn it upside down. It's been there since 1995, and no one has ever found the upside down mezuzah. So anyway, the Shin was the name for God, and Nimoy wanted to add kind of like a secret Jewish society. So he says, he just came up with it, and it stuck. Now, the rest of the story. Why is the priestly benediction like this? Well, there are all kinds of explanations, that it's, you know, the windows of God and all of that. I had a congregant who was a hand surgeon who sent me an article, which I still have somewhere in my files, that this is actually a test for leprosy. A leper cannot do this. Now, some of you can't do it. It just means you can't be priests. And you're not as cool as the rest of us who obviously have Vulcan blood. In my ancestry DNA, you know, in my 23andMe, I'm like part Vulcan. So anyway, this was a leprosy test because there's a nerve in your hand that if you have leprosy, you can't do this. And so hand surgeons actually believe that it was actually a test to make sure that the priests didn't have leprosy. Okay. Did I miss anything, Frank?
Nothing.
All right, if I miss part of the Vulcan whatever, and if you want to speak Klingon, talk to Frank at Onik. Let's see. With working every day in Jewish aspects, what is your personal prayer routine, or how do you connect to God? I connect to God every day, all the time. Ask Gary. God and I are constantly in connection. I pray every morning. And sometimes I pray in here, but a lot of times I pray before I get here. Because I determined early on that if I didn't have my daily practice, I would lose something. So I pray and study Torah and read in quiet. I need a lot of quiet time. Very often, and I don't use a prayer book, and that I think is what's unique. I've developed my own prayer ritual. I do it all from memory. I sing it all. I don't use melodies we use here. I use melodies that have just developed. Like I only sing the Debbie Friedman Shema. I don't know why. It's not the Shema I grew up with. But I do my whole thing. So if some of you like feel like an oomph somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock, if you've been sick or whatever, it's because you were stuck in my Mishra Beirach. I don't pray a lot at night. Because that's not my prayer time. My prayer time is the morning before I start my day. It grounds me. Let's see. I understand that the sacred text is is the same as the Christian Old Testament. Does anything New Testament pertain to Judaism? Well, interestingly enough, some of our books were not preserved by the Jews. In the canonization process, the rabbis cut off what they determined God actually wrote. Now, which book was debated the longest? Which book did the rabbis not want to put in the Jewish Bible? Esther. Why?
Because it doesn't have the name
of God. And for a lot of other reasons. The rabbis had a trouble with. One other reason did the rabbis not want to, if you read the discussion actually in the rabbinic text, what other problem did they have with Esther? It was named after a woman. There is a rabbi in the text during the discussion that actually says, maybe if we change it to the Book of Mordecai, we could put it in the Bible. Yeah, I feel the same way. So there are a number of books that didn't make it into our Bible because they just couldn't say that God wrote them. And probably the most important are Maccabees. All the stories of Hanukkah are preserved in the Apocrypha, which are at the back of all your Protestant Bibles. And I'm very grateful that the Apocrypha preserved the books of Maccabees and Tobit and Ecclesiasticus and all these other books that were written by Jews but were not canonized by Jews. That's very personal. I'll answer that privately. Who's my favorite grandchild? That, you don't ask me. What's the number one thing you still haven't done on your bucket list? I don't have one. I don't have a bucket list. When I was 34 years old, they told me I was going to die. And I asked God for certain things. I wanted to watch my kids grow up. I wanted this congregation to really get its footing. I had a number of things on a list at the time. And then there came a point in my life where I realized I had done everything I wanted to do. And I don't have a bucket list, but I'm married to a man with one, so we go through his bucket list. Let's see. Okay. Let's see what else is here. In all your years as a rabbi, or just your life, have you ever lost faith? And what happened to make you almost lose faith? Once. Once I gave up praying. And I almost left the rabbinate. I had a miscarriage second trimester with my first baby, and I was really angry with God. And 5 days later, I had to name a baby, and I just thought life was incredibly unfair, and I couldn't believe in that God. So I punished God. I gave all my Passover dishes to Russian immigrants and said I would never change dishes for Passover. Keep a kosher home strict. You know, I have 14 sets of dishes, but for that loss of faith, I will never change dishes for Passover, because once I make a decision. But I stopped praying for almost a year. I only prayed for work. I got up and prayed in the congregation, but I didn't pray personally. And so what is the lesson from that year of my life? Jonah. Because God gave me a baby anyway, which was really quite a blessing. I think the lesson is that I'm very respectful of people who lose faith during painful periods of their lives. And I now know for me that when you are experiencing great pain and get angry at God, that is also an act of faith, because people who don't believe don't have anything to get angry with. So I was really glad I had a God to be angry with. And I think in talking to my Christian friends and colleagues, that's another thing I love about being Jewish, because it's very Jewish to be angry at God. Rabbis are allowed to get angry at God. And so people ask me all the time, where is God, Rabbi? And my answer to people, I just gave it recently. God is when you put your feet on the floor, when you want to pull the covers up and say, I really can't do this anymore. And what makes you go on, for me, that's God. What's your favorite part of being a rabbi and a teacher? I think teaching the children, bar mitzvah class, confirmation. That's probably the thing that I will miss most on a weekly basis, because they never cease to amaze me. And then they come back and remember things and live Jewish lives and Jewish values. And when you put your heart and soul into a student, all of our teachers experience this. The tradition teaches us that a child has three parents, a mother, a father, and a teacher who makes a difference. And so I've always looked at the privilege of being the teacher who makes the difference. And to be able to share your knowledge with people, I think that's really important. So I will answer any other of your questions. I think those, I do not have a favorite grandchild. Here's the last one. What is the hardest decision you have had to make as a rabbi? The hardest decision I think I've ever had to make was whether or not I could be part of a Judaism that wasn't ethical and that wasn't that wasn't based on Torah, and I decided I could not. And so at a very young age, I decided if I was going to still do this, it was going to have to be based on ethics and values. And I was going to work with people who had ethics and values, and I was going to have a community that was based on ethics and values. And that's why I thank God every single day that we brought Rabbi Rappaport to this congregation. Because from the moment she and I sat and really talked, her ethics and her values really did shine through. And so it's a privilege to share that journey. And so I would say to you, I've worked with a lot of people over the years who've had employers who were unethical, who were in situations where they were asked to compromise their values. And I think when you do that, you compromise a part of yourself. So sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it means you don't take the straight trajectory. But ethics and values really always make a difference, and they always win out. Shabbat Shalom.